Can I start by thanking Gary for that introduction and to the Men's Ministry team for the invitation to address you this morning. It's a great honour, and I'm honoured by the presence of so many people. I want to thank also Dave, who's put together some slides for me. I was going to say that if anything goes wrong, you can be sure it's operator error, but Dave's got around that by making sure he does the slides himself. You can't hear? Can you hear now? Okay. If I move the microphone or drop my voice, just put your hand up and I'll rectify it. Now, I feel in starting, I should also act a bit like a counsel for the defence of the profession of law, because it gets bad press. Sometimes deservedly so, sometimes not. But almost uniformly, if the law appears in a news report on TV or in the newspapers, it's adverse. As I was preparing this talk, I did a Google search of lawyers' jokes, because I'm sure you've all heard some, and they're all disparaging of lawyers and the law. I looked to see, as I looked at Google, and found that it categorises lawyers' jokes into lawyers' jokes clean and lawyers' jokes dirty. I looked at some of the clean ones to see if anything was new, and nothing was. I'm not going to tell you any of them. You can do your own Google search. When I retired the second time, but 3 years ago, I shared those feelings, those negative feelings about the law. The last engagement I had was as one of three referees in a very large dispute. The Supreme Court appointed three of us to adjudicate a fight between one of the large gas companies and the American company that had built its gas fields. It was a very big dispute, very complicated. And you expect cases like that to be hard fought. But this was something new in my experience. There were lawyers on both sides, big teams. There were men that I'd known when I was at the bar. There were colleagues and some I regarded as friends. And they attacked each other unmercifully, I thought unprofessionally. They accused each other of impropriety and even dishonesty. It made our job much harder. But I wondered what had happened to the profession I'd given my life to. And I, as I say, became quite despondent. There's a happy ending. I found two answers to my feelings. The first was in a small book by Mark Fowler. He's a Brisbane solicitor, although he now lives and works in Sydney. He, if you read The Australian, you might have come across his name. He's written extensively on the topic of discrimination laws as they affect religious practice. He wrote the small book called Beauty and the Law. Odd title, you think. Law's been called many things, but not often it's called beautiful. But his thesis was that what's good is also beautiful. There's a beauty in what's good. And the practice of law is basically a practice of doing good. It's meant to bring about a peaceful and ordered society, and honesty in transactions. Now, that part of the book was interesting, but not, I suppose, so startling. What was startling was his proposition that Christian lawyers should have two audiences. So if you're a solicitor and you're writing an opinion, your audience is the client. If you're a barrister and you're preparing a case to argue, or you're arguing the case, your audience is the judge and your opponent. If you're a judge, I suppose, your audience is the parties who will be told who's won or who's lost and why, and maybe the appeal court who might have to look at your judgment. But Mark said, no, the Christian lawyer should have another audience, and that's Jesus. Now, that's startling. There's a discerning audience for you. There's someone who knows everything, sees through everything, and from whom no secrets are hidden. So there's incentive to do your best work, to not skimp on research, not avoid or evade hard questions, to give clear, honest, explicit advice. And Mark had a second point, which was that if you approach your work on that basis, that you're writing to please Jesus as well as your secular clients, some part of God's creativity will rub off on you and your work will improve. I thought that a really new way of looking at things, and a very positive way of looking at things, and it did lift my despondency. The second thing that helped was that Mark had asked me some years before, to address a conference of the Christian Lawyers Society. There is such a thing, although you don't hear much about it. At least I don't hear much about it, except on the occasions when they ask me to go along. My brief on that occasion to address the Christian Lawyers Society was to encourage young lawyers to see their profession and their practice of their profession as a Christian ministry, as a good work pleasing to God. I meant to say earlier when I was talking about my despondency that after that experience with the case I mentioned, I felt that I was dealing with the law, which had as its currency malice, greed, and a disregard for the welfare of others. And that in practicing law, what you were doing was either helping people avoid the consequences of their bad actions, or helping people who'd suffered from bad actions recover some sort of recompense, which is never complete, never fully adequate. And I thought that I'd spent my time as a lawyer is chasing after the wind, as we heard on the recent sermon series. But as I say, Mark Fowler's book helped me out of that. And also the address I'd given to the Christian Lawyer Society was assistance. I went back to what I'd said to these young lawyers. And the starting point was the proposition, which is surely right, that God is a God of justice. He loves justice. An example evidence of that in the Bible, and the first slide will show us that. Now, can you read that? No. Then let me read it out to you. I have it here. So there are three passages from the Psalms. The first is from Psalm 9. He will judge the world in righteousness. He will govern with justice. Psalm 11. The Lord is righteous. He loves justice. Psalm 89, righteousness and justice are the foundations of your throne. From Proverbs, I walk in the way of righteousness along the paths of justice. And from Amos, let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. So, the proposition is clearly God loves justice, God is righteous. But two things come from those propositions. The first is that justice and righteousness are cognate terms, that they are interchangeable. Where there's one, there's the other. You can substitute one for the other. Now, we tend to think of truth and justice as being the things that go together. And obviously, truth is essential to justice. But it's righteousness which is the basis for justice. As I say, you can't have justice unless you know the truth. You have to know the facts and circumstances of a case before you can make a decision. And once you know all the facts, the just decision is usually not hard to find. The second point to come from those passages is that law as a philosophy, as an abstract concept, is God-given. There are many philosophies of law, but the Christian one is that law is the basis of society as God wants it to be and as people should behave. The early reformers, the Lutherans in particular, if there are any Lutherans here, you should feel proud, did a lot of work on the nature of law and what its function and purpose should be. They found in the Ten Commandments a bullet point summary of all the laws which regulate human activity, And we have some examples. Again, I'll read them. I'll read from my script because I can't read this. I can't see the screen. So, the first one is you might find odd at first glance. It's the commandment to honour your father and mother. Now, that sounds like a commandment to support family life. But the Lutherans saw in it the basis of all laws which protect public authority. As I was preparing this, I went to the Criminal Code and I looked at the chapters that deal with offences to protect public order. And the first one is sedition. The second is raising or training in a militia. Now, sedition's technically inciting disaffection against the sovereign. What it means really is encouraging people to disobey the laws and disregard lawful authority. You can see why, well, that's obvious enough. Raising or training a militia, I don't know if that happens much now, but clearly the thought was that people might get together, march from Parliament House, expel the parliamentarians and imprison the Premier. Not to, so if we invite you to take part in the militia, it's a bad idea. Now, you'll tell me that that's all very interesting, but it's got no current relevance. The last time there was a sedition or an insurrection here in this country was the Eureka Stockade in the 1850s. That's why you probably can't see it, but at the bottom of the slide there's a photograph of Donald Trump, President Trump, because it's only 5 years ago that he was in trouble for allegedly raising an insurrection. He didn't have a trained militia, but he had a large mob that did go to the Capitol building and try to overturn the results of the previous election. So the laws aren't, by any means, a dead letter. Others in this category are disturbing Parliament, interfering with elections, or bribing jurors. Now, the next commandment that the Lutherans looked at, do not kill, do not commit murder. Again, some of these are straightforward, obviously covers all homicides, but it also includes now all acts of violence, all assaults, all acts of wounding, and even robbery, which is stealing with force. Now, the next was, has some interest, do not commit adultery. Again, that sounds like a commandment aimed at preserving family life. But the Lutherans saw in it a basis for laws enforcing public morality, such as prostitution, pornography, obscenity, and misusing or exploiting children. The last one, the commandment, do not steal. Again, obviously, that covers all offences of theft, but also burglary, housebreaking, all forms of fraud, obtaining benefits by deception, receiving or dealing in stolen goods, and forgery. So there's one more, the last one. Do not give false testimony. Again, some of these are obvious, perjury, and suborning or intimidating witnesses to give false evidence. But interestingly, the laws of defamation and slander. Now, they're not criminal offences. They're civil offences giving rise to a right to damages if you've been defamed. But basically, the commandment, do not give false testimony, extends to don't tell lies about other people. Don't destroy their reputations. So that's interesting. The other point the Lutherans made was to develop an ethic of the Christian ruler, which is different to the Christian's personal ethic. Hear me now? Okay. Sorry. So, as Christians in our personal lives, we're told to forgive wrongs done to us, to turn the other cheek, not to seek vengeance or revenge. If you apply that ethic as a judge or a ruler, there'd be anarchy. The the strong and the ruthless would prevail. So the Lutherans had this this theory of the ethic of the Christian ruler, who was to govern in a decent and godly way for the well-being of all his subjects, to promote justice and punish crimes, having it as the basis, or part of the basis, that proverb that God detests acquitting the guilty or convicting the innocent. And that's strong language. God detests acquitting the guilty. So the Lutherans saw the duty of the Christian ruler or judge to punish the guilty and, of course, to acquit the innocent. Now, that leads me to probably a controversial topic, and what I'm going to say now is my own views about sentencing. What I say would not be accepted by everyone and would be resented by some. But if you look at the criticism of the law, it nearly always focuses on what passes for sentencing of criminals, especially serious crimes of violence, of which we've seen far too much recently. There's an example, I saw something on the news last night which made me shake my head. So why is it that sentences that are passed often attract criticism from those involved, usually the family members of victims, but also from commentators? And I share the criticism. It's not always valid, but far too often it is. And I think there are two reasons that largely explain it. Nothing explains everything, but there are two reasons, I think, which largely explain that, and which are, I think, a blot on the functioning of the courts at the moment in our state and perhaps elsewhere. But before I come to those two reasons, can I say something in defence of the judges? Because sentencing has been made very complicated by the government. And there's a slide which... It's up on the screen. I can't see it. Yeah, thank you. Again, I'll read it out because I'm sure many, those of you at the back can't see it. So the first slide is the purposes of sentencing. And this is government mandate. So there are five. Punishment, retribution. The second is rehabilitation. Now, just pausing at those two, there's the conflict between justice and mercy. You can't be giving adequate punishment or retribution for a serious crime at the same time saying, what I must do to you, man, is to achieve your rehabilitation. It's justice or mercy. There's a tension there which, really in most cases, I think perhaps in all cases, can't be reconciled. So the other purposes of sentencing, deterrence, denunciation, that's just denunciation, public expression to the public of abhorrence of what the person has done. And the last is protection of community, protection or community safety, putting dangerous people out of harm's way. Now, as well as five purposes of sentencing, there are six principles of sentencing. Again, I'll read these out. So the first is proportionality. That is, the sentence has to meet the crime. Can't be too severe, can't be too lenient. Totality, that's when you have someone being dealt with for a number of crimes at once. So someone robs a bank, jumps in the car, drives away at high speed, in the most dangerous manner, has an accident, hurts someone. So there are maxims for the driving, there are maxims for the robbery. This principle is to say that the total sentence can't be out of proportion to the whole of the offending. Then there's parity, which is that other offenders who have been sentenced should have the same sentence should apply to offenders who commit much the same offence. This one I like, parsimony it's called, parsimony. The government says the judges should impose the least severe sentence appropriate to the circumstances. And then, of course, the judges have to take into account the circumstances of the offence and the circumstances of the offender. Now, on a busy day, the district court who do most of the sentencing, the judge might have to deal with six or seven sentences. Someone hurt in a pub brawl, someone accused, convicted of stealing, a rape, child molestation. The judge has to assess the facts of each case, the facts of the offender, first offender, hardened criminal, long criminal record, family support, no family support, and weigh up all those purposes, principles and factors and come to a sentence. So it's not surprising that occasionally things go wrong. Mostly, I think judges get it right. But in the big cases, I think the call is often wrong. And as I say, I think there are two reasons for that. I'll come at this obliquely. There are basically two ways of looking at society and looking at criminal activity. You can say people make bad choices. We're all human, we're all fallen humans, and some of us make bad choices and do bad things, and we do it deliberately. Or you can say human behaviour is influenced and really controlled by social environment, how you're brought up, where you live, how much your parents earn, have you got your education, those sorts of factors. If you take that view, it's harder to impose moral blameworthy on someone who commits a crime, because the theory is, or the proposition is, no. It wasn't a bad choice to do a bad thing. It was just the way society shaped this person. So it's society's fault in a way, not the offender's. And the solution is not to punish the offender, but to improve society by more regulations, better government programs, rehabilitation. If you take that view, you aren't going to look at a criminal and say, you're a dangerous person, you're a bad person, you've done bad things, you deserve to be punished. Society needs to be protected from you. You say, oh, you poor man. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. And you often hear that victims are overlooked on that approach, and that's because the victims are part of society and society is to blame. So the victims are partly to blame for their own misfortune. Now, that's not a view that I adhere to. It's not a view I accepted when I was a judge. And it's not a view I think that sensible judges take. But it is the view, and this is where it becomes controversial, it is a view of, I think, too many of our judges who have been appointed by the government that was in power for many years. That's democracy. They were elected. But it was that philosophy, that viewpoint, which led to their choice of judges with that attitude. So I think that's a problem. There's a second factor which is, in a sense, allied. I don't wish to sound political, but there's no other way of putting this, I think. Too many judges were appointed, to the district court especially, not on the basis of their established and proven, demonstrated legal ability, their knowledge of the law, and their capacity demonstrated to apply the law in particular circumstances. They were appointed because of party allegiance or friendship. And I've spoken to some of these people, and they have tried, I think, genuinely to fulfil the role they're appointed to. But deep down, they have the sense of inadequacy. They know that they really shouldn't have been appointed. They know they feel not up to the job, and more than that, they don't feel qualified to judge others because they don't feel they should have been appointed. They'll live with that openly, but you can have conversations with them where that sort of attitude, that sort of sense of of failing really comes out. Now, that's my personal take on much of the reasons for our present situation. Let me pass now, if I can, having been too controversial. Let me pass now, if I can, to three cases which demonstrate, I think, or provide illustrations of how the law and righteousness intersect, or perhaps don't. Two of the cases I was involved in, well, I wasn't. The first was a murder case, a murder trial, that came from events not far from here. There were two young men in their late 20s, hopeless drug addicts, addicted to heroin, living in squalor, somewhere behind Noosaville. One man in particular felt his life was useless. He saw no hope, he saw no future. He had no work, he lived on Social Security. He lived day to day for his drug addiction. And he was in despair. And he saw no value in life, and he wanted to end it. So he asked his friend if he would help him. They bought a lethal dose of heroin. The man who was in the worst way didn't want to inject himself, so he asked his friend to do it. And out of love for his friend, out of compassion, the other young man injected the lethal dose. There's a dead body. The police come, the ambulance come. The young man's got nothing to hide. He's acted quite openly. He's done his friend his last service. But he's charged with murder. As murder. The causing the death of another human being by any means is unlawful. If the act is done with the intention of causing death, that's murder. And that's what he did. His friend wanted to die. He helped him. And he thought he'd done his friend a last service, as I say. But no, it was murder. And he was tried, and he was convicted. He hoped, no doubt, I mean, the facts were clear, the law was clear, there wasn't much of a defence, but he was hoping, no doubt, for a sympathetic verdict from the jury. The jury said, no, that's murder. There was an appeal. There was really no ground to appeal. Nothing was wrong with the trial. But the judge of the Court of Appeal were sorry for the young man. And they searched around, they found something wrong with the summing up and ordered a new trial, hoping that the verdict would be different the second time. The second trial was conducted by Debbie Mullen. Some of you may know her. She is or was the Chancellor of the Archdiocese and legal advisor to the Archbishop. Now, juries are instructed... pardon me. Juries are instructed, you find the facts, you apply the laws as explained to you and bring in a verdict. You don't get swayed by emotion. Your job is to uphold the law. But juries also have a right, they've always had it, to bring in a verdict, of course, a merciful verdict, to ignore in appropriate cases the law and the facts and bring in a verdict that they think meets the justice of the case. And Justice Mullins went flat out in the summing up to stress that part of a jury's prerogative. You don't... Yes, you must accept my instructions. Yes, you must find the facts. Yes, you must apply the law to the facts. But you have this right to ignore all those things if you think it's right to do so and bring in a verdict of acquittal or a lesser verdict. And she said, look, you can convict, if you want, of assisting a suicide. That's a criminal offence, but nothing like as serious as murder. Anyway, despite that exhortation, really, to show the young man some mercy, the jury came back and said, no, murder. So two juries, picked at random from the community, representing community attitudes, would not tolerate, would not countenance take a human life. They put a high value on human life. Now, you can, if you like, compare that attitude with that of the parliamentarians who passed the euthanasia laws, the voluntary assisted dying act, which allows the terminally ill to end their own lives. And I expect, no doubt, to make it easier to get rid of the old and the unwanted. The juries had put a much higher value on human life than did Parliament. Now, the second case where righteousness and the law perhaps didn't quite meet is a case that I was the judge. I was on one occasion it's called the applications on call judge. In the Air Force, that would have been the duty officer. But the judges were rostered so that someone was always available if after hours or on weekends some urgent order had to be made. And I was called in one night, on Friday night, at 10 o'clock. I should have gone in earlier, but my associate, judges had associates. The role is part research assistant, part personal assistant, part court official. And we was appointed lawyers, or students who just graduated, about to start their careers, to give them a year of practical training or learning, and that's how the law actually works, as part of their career development. I had this young man, very engaging young man, but it was a Friday night, and he went out in the town with his mates and didn't take the call. So I got a call late, but at 10 o'clock I went into the court not knowing what was happening. And I was met by lawyers from the Crown Law Office and from the Department of Health. And they wanted an order from me to permit an operation to separate two conjoined twins, Siamese twins. They're only a couple of weeks old, and if they weren't separated, they would both die, and quite quickly. If they were separated, one of the twins would certainly die. One had a good chance of survival. And the doctors wouldn't operate without an order from the court authorising it, which was obviously a surprise to me at the time, and looking back, it's still a bit of a surprise. Because Supreme Court judges have lots of powers, but authorising murder isn't one of them. So the situation, though, was this. I had no chance, no time to research anything, no time to look up law reports or textbooks. The girls would die unless the operation was done very quickly, and the doctors wouldn't operate unless they made the order. So I made the order. The operation went ahead next morning. The one little girl did survive and went on to have a normal childhood. But I was left with having to write a judgment, because you can't just make orders. You have to justify them by reasons which are published. And I had to find a legal reason for saying that an operation that would kill one little girl was lawful. I looked at the section in the criminal code which provides a defence. It comes from an earlier doctrine of the law called the doctrine of necessity, which says that in cases of extreme emergency, someone can be justified in committing a crime if that's the only way the person can escape from the dire situation. The doctrine had its origin in a shipwreck in the 1700s. There were some survivors in a small boat, but many of them died because of lack of food after days at sea. In the end, there were three people left, two sailors and a boy, ship's boy. They all faced certain death within a day or two. So the two sailors killed the boy and ate him. I hope you enjoyed your breakfast. They were, in fact, the two sailors were, in fact, rescued not long after by a passing ship. What they'd done was obvious. When the ship got back to England, the two sailors were put on trial for murder. And they said, no, it's not murder. Necessity drove us to it. if we hadn't done what we did, three people would have died. By killing the boy, two survived. Two lives left to serve king and country. And the judge just said, yes, there is a doctrine of necessity, but it doesn't extend to murder. You can commit crimes to get away from dire circumstances, but not murder. What happened to the sailors? They were put in jail and released quietly some months later. But that left me without that doctrine as a justification for the order I had made. I did find, however, two other sections in the code. One puts an obligation on anyone who has care or custody of someone else. Parents is the obvious example. But doctors in hospitals is another. The obligation is to provide what's necessary to preserve life. So a doctor who has a patient is obliged, the patient's in his care, has an obligation under the law to provide what's necessary, to give what services are necessary to save life and keep people alive. And there's another section which says that if a doctor performs an operation in good faith and with reasonable skill, in good faith means for a proper purpose, then the doctor is not liable for the consequences if the operation goes wrong. So putting those two sections together, I thought I could justify the order. But that left a different problem, because when a judge is making an order for young people, for children, the fundamental principle, the one that can't be ignored, is that the order must be for the welfare, the benefit, or the best interests of the child. And whichever way you looked at it, you couldn't say that the order was in the best interests of both children. Certainly in one, but not the other. The operation was bound to kill one little girl. And it didn't matter that she was going to die anyway. Hastening death, is murder. So I had to find, what's the justification? How can you say, how could I say, making this order, which I had made, was in the best interests of the child, of the children? And the best I could come up with was the arguments of the utilitarians, which is pretty crass, but there it is. The argument is, what is best for the greatest number is moral, is justifiable. That, of course, ignores the interests of the people who aren't in the majority, but it's a basis of morality. It was the only one that I could find. So I justified it on that basis. Can I take a straw poll? Hands up. Who here would have made the same decision? That's comforting. But some wouldn't, obviously. I was at the time wrestling with questions of theology or morality. I was just faced with the situation where the doctors wouldn't do what they should have done unless I said so. And there's no one else to say so. But that's a case where you can say, perhaps, that righteousness and the law didn't quite come together. The third example I'll give you is another murder trial, and one in which I was the trial judge. And again, it came from events not far from here. There was a community of people who lived in what had been a pine forest plantation between just north of Gympie, I think, just north of Gympie. So when the trees were removed, the area was left with crisscross forestry roads, and somehow people got title to build small houses on those roads, and they formed their own community. They would have been really fringe dwellers in society. They lived on the outskirts of society. They would have known their way to the local Centrelink office, but other than that, would have had no contact with, would have avoided contact with government officials. But they had their own little community, And they ran their own little society, and they socialised well. But there was one couple, a big man, small woman, and he was brutal to her. He fancied himself as a ladies' man, but one of the other women said to him, "You've got no show. You're fat, lazy, and stupid." Anyway, he decided he'd like to change his woman. He was told that if he divorced her, he'd have to share what he had with her. He wouldn't have had much, but he wasn't prepared to share, so he killed her and sank the body in a lake. She was very popular and a friend of everyone, so he had to explain her absence. So he said, "Oh, she's gone away. She wanted to see the world. She's going to start off by going around Australia." No one believed him because she was, as I say, popular and friendly. No one believed that she would have left without saying she was going. He claimed to have got a postcard from her from somewhere in central Queensland, but his story came to an end when the body came to the surface of the lake. So he's charged with murder. I'm telling you this story because of the manner in which that community came together in defence of their friend. None of them, they were all convinced that he'd killed her. None of them had proof. None of them had seen or heard what happened. But they all had fragments of evidence which, when put together by the prosecutor, came to a strong circumstantial case. And they all came along to court, and I'm sure they hated coming to court, just to tell their story, their part of it. And they did so without embellishment. No one tried to make things worse for the accused than they could honestly say. But I hate to say it to you, but they began to annoy me because they were so scruffy. They were really dishevelled and scruffy people. I ran a very formal court. I insisted on formal manners and formal dress. I found that made for a more efficient conduct of cases. It got rid of emotion. It got rid of unnecessary arguments. People concentrated on what they were doing. And these people, as I say, began to feel that they weren't showing sufficient respect for the court by coming along as they did. And in the end, I was about to explode when one witness came in. He was a big man, and he was wearing very short nylon running shorts, joggers, and some sort of athletic shirt. It wasn't a singlet, but it wasn't far off. And I was about to say to him, "Go away and come back when you're properly dressed," when I suddenly realised that he was properly dressed. In his eyes, he was wearing what the well-dressed man wears to court. He had gone out and bought a new outfit. Everything he had on was new. And he'd done that out of respect for the court, which he trusted to bring justice to his murdered friend. And they're all the same. All these people that you might look down upon, and I'm afraid to say I did begin to look down upon some of them, had that same burning desire for justice that is innate in every human being, because we're all made in the image of God. So it is so important to see the reality behind appearance. And I'm just glad I saw that reality in time. But they did get justice for the friend. The man was convicted and he's in jail. Now, that brings me to the end of what I had to say. I hope you found it interesting. I began as counsel for the defence. Can I finish perhaps as a judge would, to sum up the good and the bad? Overall, there's far more good in the law than bad. It is a force for the good of society, bringing about order and peace and honesty in transactions. Judges do a difficult job, and I think if you have time, when you say your prayers, you might include one for the judges. Thank you.